good to see so many people out on a Wednesday night. I mean, what could be more wonderful than to sit Zazen together? Especially since it's raining out there anyway. On these Wednesdays, during this practice period, we've been considering the Bodhisattva's engagement with the world. How do we engage with the world? The kind of how and the why of it. And I thought, you know, it may be good just to pause a little bit and consider what this means, Bodhisattva and engagement in the world. The path of the Bodhisattva acknowledges the deep interconnection of all life and the Bodhisattva vows to awaken from the delusion of separateness for the sake of all beings. Now, this may seem kind of distant or too hard to see, even as a possibility for ourselves. But really, the path of the Bodhisattva is about how we, as ordinary people, with this body, this mind, this life, and these problems, can find generosity, compassion, and wisdom right here and now as we reach out to help others. It is really about integrating whatever arises in this moment, recognizing it as my life. This is my life. No matter how sweet, or how bitter. As we've talked about in the past few weeks, and if you missed the earlier talks, they are all online if you want to catch up. As we've talked about, this path is one of not turning away from the world, not turning away from personal troubles, but of living in the world and working to bring about contentment and security for all beings. And while there are the archetypal bodhisattvas like Avalokiteshvara or Kanon, her name we chant when we chant the Heart Sutra. So while there are these kind of special archetypal bodhisattvas who kind of exemplify lives dedicated to eradicating the suffering in the world and have awesome power, radiance, and wisdom. And while that's true, we should also remember that bodhisattvas include us. You and me, kind of what I call Jane and Joe bodhisattvas, dealing with the messiness of our lives as we cultivate the tools of mindfulness and compassion through our practice and through our study of the Dharma. So I propose a new slogan, Bodhisattvas are us. This series started by considering how bodhisattvas view the world. Like, how do the bodhisattvas view the world? What's that approach? And the bodhisattva's attitude towards other beings. So that was kind of the first talk in a bit. And then we thought about the roles of conscience and courage as we take a place in the world. And last week, the topic was the challenge of speaking truth to ourselves and speaking truth to power. But tonight is a scary topic, appropriate considering how close we are to Halloween. At least this topic is one that I have found quite frightening times in my life. The topic is conflict. How do we meet conflict? A friend of mine once described herself as conflict adverse. averse, conflict averse. And I thought, yep, I could say the same thing about myself. Vicky, our Shuso, our head monk for this practice period, last Sunday in her seminar on conflict, asked people about conflict and how they approached it, and it was really clear. Most people would rather avoid conflict. So it's not something we look forward to. And yet conflict, whether it's a writ large or small, whether it is manifested in our opposition to a pipeline or in an argument with our spouse, conflict is pervasive in this world. Norman Zolkitz and Norman Fisher, the teacher who ordained Kate and I, published a book of poetry, or kind of a series of poems, titled Conflict. And I remember his friend and fellow poet, Annie Tardos, I think that's her name, wrote on the back, the blurb on the back of that book, and it went like this. The conflict Norman Fisher speaks of in this poem is an inherent component of the universe. He writes of the human dilemma, the struggles of daily life, and the desire to hold the world in place, showing us how not to be mired in one spot. Conflict is an inherent component of the universe. So no matter how much we try to avoid conflict, it will arise. It is intrinsic to our human experience. And while we may consider conflict unfortunate, maybe a waste of our precious time, or we consider conflict destructive, a failure of some kind perhaps, or a breakdown, it's also true that conflict can be a really powerful teacher, shifting us out of our comfort zone and opening us up to kind of new insights, wider views. Conflict is scary. Engaging in a conversation that we know will end in conflict, or at least be challenging, is something most of us approach with some fear, hesitation, perhaps afraid the conflict will escalate, causing us even more painful feelings and making the situation even worse than it is already. Perhaps you, like me, say things to yourself like this before you venture into a conflict zone. Well, maybe it's not that important. I really should talk to her about this problem, but maybe it will go away on its own. So I'll leave it for a while. There's no sense in stirring up something that makes us both uncomfortable. And if I go to him, I'm going to make myself susceptible. It's really his responsibility. He should come to me to resolve this conflict. You say things like that sometimes? At least think them. And let's not forget internal conflict, right? The kind of skirmishes that play out within our own minds and hearts. Maybe you think, I'm not going to think about this right now. I'll put it off for another day. And of course, there are many other kind of unhelpful and unhealthy ways that we can deal with conflict, as I'm sure we have all experienced. But I found that this author, Diane Musho Hamilton, who wrote a book called Everything is Workable, a Zen Approach to Conflict Resolution. There's Zen everything these days, isn't there? But actually, it's a pretty good book. And she draws some interesting connections between how we face and don't face conflict and the traditional three poisons of Buddhism. Poisons of greed, aversion, and ignorance. So I thought I'd like to just talk about those a little bit and then maybe talk a little bit about what is a Buddhist view or a tradition, the Buddhist tradition. How should we, how can we approach conflict? So first, Diane Hamilton brings up avoidance, as she calls us the poison of ignorance. We avoid, we ignore, we kind of feign ignorance. In other words, it's a kind of impulse to walk away and disengage rather than face a conflict. So perhaps you or someone you know quickly changes the topic, right, when the threat of conflict appears on the horizon. Or maybe the conversation just suddenly seems to freeze as tension rises, right? Just like people stop talking or engaging. I notice in myself a kind of emotional withdrawing and a kind of slowing down of my thought. Maybe it's really a kind of hunkering down when I feel threatened by conflict. Some people I know, when challenged with issues that our society faces today, like climate warming, homelessness, serious drug use, we use similar language when confronted with a personal conflict. Well, not much I can do about that. People will be people. What are you going to do? And it's really not that walking away from conflict is necessarily unskillful. I've walked away several times from what might have become fistfights in my younger days. But if that is our habit pattern, turning away, don't we really just close ourselves off to discovering more about who we are and what is the real nature of what threatens us? We not only kind of isolate ourselves and begin to see ourselves over time, I think it's just being ineffective if we constantly turn away. Ineffective, not fully engaged, and really not fully alive in this world. When we say things to ourselves like, it's just not worth it over and over, it subtly becomes, I'm not worth it. I'm not worth it. The next style that Diane Hamilton talks about in conflict, she calls accommodation. And she connects this to the Buddhist understanding of greed. And she uses the word passion here rather than greed because she wants to emphasize the tendency of kind of constantly reaching out to grasp and hold on. And this is the quality to manipulate and cling to really get what we want. In terms of conflict, this means trying to avoid separation at all costs, separation from others. And we do this, or a person really emphasizing accommodation does this, by deferring to the preferences of others. Deferring to the preferences of others. Sure, we can go to Starbucks. No, I don't drink coffee, but that's okay. As Diane Hamilton points out, the accommodating type would rather be liked than thought of as difficult. And when we constantly see our value as coming from others, we may become resentful, though, when our accommodating ways are not really recognized and praised. And as you can imagine, like avoidance, accommodation leads us into the woods of really poor self-worth. if that becomes the habitual way that we deal with conflict, always accommodating. And if this is the case, we lose. We lose our opportunity to develop courage, inner strength, and a real sense of authenticity that we need, really, to meet the challenges of this life. Because life will give us challenges. Perhaps you've heard of the infamous Stanford prison experiment. The psychologist Philip Zimbardo, interested in social accommodation, like how we kind of will start to accommodate to others, set up an experiment where students took on the roles of guards and prisoners and simulated a prison life in the basement of a Stanford University building. Within 6 days, the experiment had to be terminated, or even though they had planned to run it for a month, had to be terminated because of the cruelty that the student guards were inflicting on the student prisoners. The student guards almost unconsciously acted with greater and greater cruelty to fall in line with what they thought other guards were doing. And the same kind of strange accommodation was happening amongst the student prisoners. They started to lose all sense of self-esteem, self-worth, even though everyone knew this is just an experiment. Zimbardo later devoted much of his career to developing ways to help strengthen a sense of integrity and personal ethic values after this experiment. So accommodation, which is a good way to deal with conflict at times. Flexibility is a virtue, but also a fault when it becomes our usual habitual response. And so the last style is aversion, which Diane Hamilton calls aggression. And it's our instinctive response to push back right away. Rather than walking away or accommodating, the response is assertion or even attack. I think we all know someone who is usually up for a friendly fight or quarrel, out to win even in the most minor of conflicts. And assertion can be positive, of course. It can be a positive energy, one that catalyzes and one that gives us courage to take risks, and one that helps us form and honor a sense of integrity. On the other hand, habitual aggression is destructive of all relationships and creates a sense of separation. And I think it also deludes us. And this is perhaps where it's most poisonous, because aggression can prevent us from holding a wider view and seeing when our position is not the only one or even the best one, because we're so caught in like getting our view across. Anyway, so these are just a thumbnail sketch of some ways that we approach conflict. And this sketch should just be kind of a skillful means, in no way kind of definitive. Skillful maybe just to help us examine how do you approach conflict? And how may you over time change that so it's a little more balanced, a little more wholesome? And I think understanding these or thinking about them can also help us understand when someone is coming at us in a certain way, you know. So, the world and our life being as it is, we will at times enter conflict. Mostly, I think we have conflict with our lovers and friends and family, but also with our coworkers, bosses. Sometimes we have conflict with big business, government, and even strangers. Have you ever listened to Donald Trump? Seems to have conflict with many people in America. So what is it that grabs us and sometimes even hauls us against our will into conflict? And what is it about conflict that really obscures our understanding and leads us into battle with others? Conflict is a strange and twisted intimacy. We are together and yet also isolated. We are together and we also are misunderstood. And paradoxically, the more that we are embroiled in this kind of intimate dance of conflict with someone, the more alone we feel. And I believe this is true, whether it's a heated argument with a spouse or an old friend, or it's a shouting match on a picket line. So how might a bodhisattva, how may we navigate through a time of conflict? You're all waiting for this part, right? Like, what's the answer? Well, our fundamental practice that we do on this cushion and here in the Zendo is to be present moment by moment. And as I mentioned earlier in this talk, a bodhisattva integrates whatever arises in this moment, recognizing it as one's life, no matter how sweet or how bitter. The first noble truth of the Buddha was that life contains dukkha, or dissatisfaction, right? The Four Noble Truths. Life contains dissatisfaction, or dukkha, the Pali word. He stressed this not because it's news. We all know this, right? It's not news. We all know this to be a truth. He stressed this because we always want life to be different. We want our life to be free of dukkha. And we spend so much of our time squirming around trying to avoid this truth of our life. The Buddha, in his teaching, says, stop squirming and look at this truth with full compassionate awareness. See it clearly and understand its nature. Then you can begin to appreciate the causes of dukkha. So, here's my suggestion. When a conflict begins to arise, try to discipline yourself to stop saying, how do I get out of here intact? Or, what an idiot, I'm going to set him straight. And begin telling yourself, of course. This is part of what it means to be alive in this world. Of course. This is what it means to be alive in this world. Let me not turn away. Let me take a breath, bring awareness to arising feelings, and practice with this situation. And two more things that I think are absolutely important. Let me not treat the other as other. And let me not blame. Let me not blame. As soon as we treat the other, as being separate, as being the one who is confused when I'm not, as being the one who's stubborn when I'm not, we're already lost. As soon as we lay the blame, whether it's blaming the other or even blaming the self, we've already wandered off the path of real possibility of finding out more about who we are and what this world is. Surely, this radical presence is the beginning of dropping unproductive conversation when in conflict. and finding a really authentic voice to express what is most important while honoring ourselves and honoring the other. This is a practice of awareness and a practice of karma. Awareness is pretty obvious, right? We're in this present moment. But it's also a practice of karma, because our future depends on what we do or don't do at this moment. A practice of awareness, a skillful choice, slowly creating new ways to respond. This moves us away from the rough waters, moves us away from rough waters that may appear in our future. Does that make sense? So, unfortunately, I don't think there's a formula for successfully handling conflict. But becoming aware of how we react to conflict will open our awareness to how others, our friends, co-workers, public figures on TV react, and that can help us to respond rather than reacting ourselves. I think this awareness will help us choose our response according to circumstances, according to what seems most appropriate. And over time, I think we can bring a sense of curiosity, maybe confidence and a good deal of patience. This moment in our life, what is it? Let us not treat the other as other. And let us not lay blame. Not doing those two things, what's your next step? That's your homework. Last Sunday, Vicky Arshuso ended her talk on conflict by giving some suggestions that I think really bear repeating. So I couldn't come up with some great ideas, so I thought I'd rely on hers to kind of finish this up. So she suggested cultivation of compassion for oneself and for the other before you head into the conflict, if you know you're going to, like, I got to go talk to my boss or I got to talk to somebody about this. To practice gratitude, to reflect on how that person has been helping me in some way. And what's really interesting in Vicky's talk, you know, she used Donald Trump as an example. How can you practice gratitude with Donald Trump? I thought, it's impossible. But she said, it was exceedingly challenging, but she said, I'm grateful for the way Donald Trump is bringing up to awareness thoughts and feelings that some people have inside so that we can all be aware of them. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. You know, to really, these people that support Donald Trump, all these, yeah. Now I get to understand a little bit. Respect for others, acknowledging the Buddha nature, the kind of shared qualities that we have with other people. And finally, stop, breathe, and then engage. It reminded me so much of that little poem that maybe you learned when you were kids. Stop, look, and listen. Before you cross the street, use your eyes and your ears before you use your feet. Everyone looks at me blank. I guess that's, you didn't learn that one. Oh, well. Okay. So I'll stop here talking.